This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we'll discuss the history of Temple B'nai Israel in Kalamazoo, which is celebrating its 150th anniversary this month. But first, Jason Dalton is accused of killing six people and severely wounding two others in three separate shootings in the Kalamazoo area on February 20th. Dalton was found competent to stand trial, but that does not preclude him from mounting an insanity defense. To explain how this works, we've turned to Tanya Krausfielen. She's a professor at the Western Michigan University Thomas M. Cooley Law School. She has also been a criminal defense attorney. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Can you give us a brief history of how mental capacity is considered in deciding guilt or innocence and in the defense that a criminal defendant can put out?
That's an excellent question. Yes. Going back to the earliest times in our criminal justice system, we as a society have always been hesitant to prosecute and punish the very, very young and the very, very mentally ill. And the thought behind that is someone who is very young does not have a completely developed brain, and someone who is very mentally ill, there is some illness causing the brain not to function properly. And because our system defines crimes by a guilty act and a guilty state of mind, when the juvenile or youthful offender or the individual with mental illness acts in what otherwise would be considered a crime, there's a question of whether they formed that evil state of mind or that criminal state of mind. And to this day, we still carry that concept out in our system because we have a separate system for juvenile offenders, and there's been a lot of law recently about the lack of capacity until someone's about the age of 22-ish, and we still allow for the insanity defense in our community because we continue to recognize that idea that someone who has a serious mental illness can't form that evil criminal state of mind the way someone can who doesn't have that serious mental disease.
So as I noted, Jason Dalton has been found competent to stand trial. Explain the difference between being found competent to stand trial and mounting an insanity defense.
Right. And what's interesting is both of those concepts can take place in one trial, in one case. Competency is what we refer to as a procedural defense, and insanity is a legal defense. So let me start with competency. Competency requires that a defendant be able to participate in his case, in his defense. And so we ask ourselves questions like, is this offender able to understand the nature of the charges against him? And does he have the capacity to assist and communicate with his lawyer regarding his defense? Now, competency, what we're looking at is, can we continue to prosecute this individual right now in real time? If somebody is incompetent, and it has to be determined by a mental health professional, and I'll explain that in a second, we can't continue to prosecute them. Our system of justice says that it would be unfair to prosecute someone who, due to mental defect, cannot understand what's going on and can't participate in his case. Now, how this usually comes up is the defense attorney or someone within the system will note that the individual either has a history of mental illness and or is presenting symptoms of mental illness. And it's often raised by the defense attorney with the court to say, hey, you know, look, Your Honor, my client has a serious mental illness, and because of that, he doesn't understand the nature of the charges and he can't assist me in the defense. Once that issue is raised, the case actually takes a timeout. And everything is put on hold while the defendant is examined by an appropriate mental health official and a determination is made if there's a mental illness and if it is making him incompetent to stand trial.
So we have reached the point where we do know Jason Dalton is competent to stand trial. We don't know yet what's going to happen when they actually get to a trial date. But if someone were mounting an insanity defense, what sort of evidence are they allowed to present in court to make the case that perhaps this person did commit the act for which they've been charged, but they were in such a state at the time that we cannot find them guilty of it?
Yeah, you said something in your question that is an excellent point that I'd like to start with, and that's when we're talking about the insanity defense, we're talking about what the defendant's state of mind was at the time of the alleged offense. So competency, we're looking at the defendant's state of mind during the actual proceedings themselves. Insanity goes to what was that person's state of mind at the time. And in this particular case, or any case where insanity is raised, there are a whole host of types of evidence that can be used. For example, does the person have a mental health history? That's going to be one of the first starting points for the mental health professional that examines the individual to determine if they were insane at the time that the offense was committed. Because in the state of Michigan, it has to be a serious mental health issue, a serious mental state or disease. So that has to be determined by a mental health professional. Then it comes down to how was the person acting? What did the person say? And in this case, there is some evidence that someone who had been inside the car with the defendant called 911 and said, look, dude's acting crazy, or this was a crazy ride, or something to that effect. And lay people can actually make observations about whether someone is, quote-unquote, acting crazy. So really, any of that type of evidence, mental health professionals about the disease or defect, things the defendant said or did leading up to and during the alleged offense, and what other people witnessed regarding the defendant's statements and conduct all become relevant questions.
So there's an interesting point there about this: the defendant's actions at the time or leading up to the committing of the crime. And I guess that leads me to wonder if that statement from the person who got this Uber ride about how the driver was erratic and was going all over the place, is that going to be maybe more salient to the question than some other things like Mr. Dalton's outburst in court during a preliminary exam, where, of course, that's well after the crime has been committed. So,
sure.
So do his actions leading right up to the crime, or maybe the time he was arrested, is that going to maybe be more relevant, at least legally, than what might have happened afterward?
Well, it depends what we're talking about. It's going to be more relevant if we're talking about the issue of insanity, because, again, with insanity, we're focusing on the defendant's state of mind at the time of the alleged offense. So those witnesses who were in his car that day or who observed his driving that day, that is really relevant and likely admissible to his state of mind at the time of the offense. Now, any conduct that happened inside the courtroom, while it may have some relevance to his state of the mind at the time of the offense, if it relates to his mental disease or defect, to me it seems like it has more relevance, his conduct in the courtroom, on whether he is currently competent to stand trial. And again, two very different concepts.
And that's already been determined. He is competent to stand trial.
It has been, but here's the interesting thing about competency. It can be raised at any time during the proceedings because, again, the concept is procedural. In other words, we don't want to continue prosecuting someone who's not competent to stand trial. And let me give you an example of that I think will help the listeners understand, is oftentimes people with mental disease or defect have to be medicated. And if they're appropriately medicated, the manifestations of their illness can be brought under control. If the individual stops taking their medication, they can start, again, exhibiting the behavior that's a manifestation of their mental disease or defect. If that happens, sometimes the case has to take a time out while the person resumes their medication and gets back to a sustainable level of competency. It's not uncommon for competency to actually come and go in the course of a trial.
So on the other side of the courtroom, we have the prosecution. What are some of the things that they can present to make the argument that this person is guilty, should not be found guilty by reason of insanity, and that was not a mitigating factor, if you will, in the crime that was committed.
Sure. Actually, very similar to what I mentioned earlier, the prosecutor is going to be looking at the defendant's behavior and statements leading up to the time of the offense. And if there are individuals who can speak to the defendant's ability to think and act rationally, that is going to be very helpful to the prosecutor to try to negate the insanity defense.
One of the main reasons, of course, that we have a criminal justice system in our society is to protect the citizens at large from people who would do them harm. And I suppose that is what some people may wonder about, why we have a possibility here of someone being found not guilty by reason of insanity. Should people be worried about the possibility that someone who is found not guilty by reason of insanity, that they are going to walk free and perhaps be amongst us again, capable of committing an act like what we saw in February in Kalamazoo?
You raise such an interesting question, and you're absolutely right. There are instances in our legal history where people with severe mental illness have committed heinous crimes against other individuals, and that can be scary. But what people have to understand is that a verdict of not guilty by reason of insanity does not release the individual back into the community. That word not guilty as part of the verdict sounds like the person would be released from the criminal justice system, but the exact opposite is true. An individual who is found not guilty by reason of insanity actually becomes under the control of the probate or mental health system. And in the state of Michigan, there are still a few dedicated facilities throughout the state that deal specifically with people with mental health situations. And so that's where the individual would go. And they stay in that mental health facility until such time that the probate court system decides that they're no longer a threat to themselves or the community.
Michigan also has an option for a defendant to be found guilty but mentally ill. What would happen then?
Yeah, guilty but mentally ill is not really a defense at all. All it is a flag to the Department of Corrections that the individual was found by the jury to have mental health issues. So if that is the verdict that is lodged, the person does in fact go to prison and is designated to receive the mental health treatment available by the state.
As I noted, you have done some work in criminal defense. Based on your experience, is it common to see someone raise the insanity defense at trial?
It's not uncommon. And especially, and I don't mean for this to sound like any type of political statement at all, but we live in a time when mental health funding is not abundant. And there's all kinds of statistics and data that indicate that the prisons in our country are filled with people with mental illness. So that's my way of leading into the answer that no, it's not uncommon. It doesn't happen a lot, but it's not uncommon. I think the more interesting part of the answer to that question is very rarely does a jury find a defendant not guilty by reason of insanity.
And that was going to be my next question was,
yeah.
You know, as a defense, is it something that has a high percentage of working, or is it something that, you know, maybe just a few juries here and there? I don't know if we could put a percentage on it, say, yes, not guilty by reason of insanity.
I don't know. There probably is a percentage. I don't have that at my fingertips. But, you know, interestingly, I think a lot of juries think that it's easy to fake mental illness, or that a defendant is using it as an excuse, or they feel very much like the question you asked a few minutes ago, that, yeah, we think this person has some serious mental health issues, but boy, we just don't want them back out on the street because they're dangerous.
Tanya Krause-Phelan, thank you very much for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Tanya Krause-Phelan is a professor at Western Michigan University's Thomas M. Cooley Law School. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Temple B'nai Israel in Kalamazoo is celebrating its 150th anniversary this year. A series of events are planned for June 10th through 12th. We're going to spend some time examining the history of the Reform Jewish community in the greater Kalamazoo area with two members of Temple B'nai Israel's congregation, Ray Ziering and Jacob Weintraub. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, yes.
Let's start back in the 1860s. How big was the Jewish community in this area at that time?
You know, the Jewish community really started in the 1840s with Manus Israel. He was the first recorded Jew that came into the area. He was a merchant. And then following him in the 1840s and 50s, a number of other Jews who became prominent in the Jewish community came. By the 1860s, there were 22 founding members of the congregation. Now, there may have been other Jewish families in the area that perhaps didn't join, but we don't know that. So by the 1860s, there were approximately 20-some-odd families, and they wanted to have a proper burial place. They wanted to have consecrated ground for their loved ones. And so that was the impetus that got the first group to get together.
So the main interest being a proper place to bury the dead.
Yes. In 1865, I think it was December 1865, they got together and purchased property at Mountain Home Cemetery on West Main. And it was consecrated in that January. The congregation really was incorporated the following year, 1866. So that's the date that we talk about when we say we're 150 years old, is from 1866.
And that area on West Main that you talk about, what would you see there today?
You would see a historic cemetery. I mean, Jacob is our caretaker, custodian. What would you call your title?
More of a manager, maybe.
Okay.
I'm responsible for making sure the maintenance gets done, selling plots if people want them, answering questions about historical. We'll have families come through from time to time. Yeah, and that was really established in December of 1865, even before the temple itself was organized.
But if you want to know what you'll find there, you'll find really almost all of the original settlers to Kalamazoo were buried. The Jewish settlers are buried there of the Reform Movement. So you have a lot of the prominent names if you go through our history. So you have the Desenbergs, and you have the Rosenbaums, and you have the Foles, and you have Cohens, and you have Stearns, all of these names who were the business people of Kalamazoo. They're all buried there. Beautiful old stones. Some of them are so faded that you'd really almost have to rub them to be able to see what they are. In our cemetery also is the grave of Edward Israel. What was the expedition to the...
I should know that, and I can't... I've seen it, and I can't
Perry,
remember.
Right. Admiral Perry.
There's a historical marker.
There is.
Yeah, there's
correct.
a historical
marker right on West Main, and his grave is just in the cemetery. Some of the original members, the stones have writing in German because they were largely German immigrants, the merchants and others.
So... are people surprised when they find out? I have to admit, I was a little surprised when I read this, that the first synagogue in Michigan, as we now know it, was actually built in Kalamazoo.
Well, you know, it was a surprise to us, too. We didn't know it. I mean, we knew that our temple was very old, and we were extremely proud. At least I've always adored the photograph of the South Street Temple. It was, to me, just a little jewel. But we didn't realize that we were the first congregation in the state to build a separate building to serve as a synagogue. Otherwise, the smaller congregations were either in storefronts or in personal homes as we began. That was discovered by a person from Detroit, actually. What was his name, Jacob?
Richard Cavalier.
Yes.
Was a member of one of the very large conservative congregations in suburban Detroit now. And he was looking around. He found on our website that this first temple was dedicated. And I can't remember, it was 18, 1875,
correct.
And he sent us a note and he called. And in fact, I wound up talking to him. And he said, if this is true, it changes life as we know it. And up until that point, Congregation Sherat Tzedek in Detroit had claimed to have the first building. And he was the one who did all the research. He went through the archives at the Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati and what archives they had in the Detroit area and found, in fact, that was when our first temple was dedicated, and that was the first one in the state.
So over the years, where did people with Temple B'nai Israel worship in Kalamazoo? Because, of course, people know that synagogue is no longer there. So give us maybe a brief history of kind of where people ended up over the years worshiping and meeting.
Well, originally they started in people's homes until they had enough finances to build the first temple on South Street. Now, I'd like to talk about where the temple was on South Street. It's kind of like South Street and Farmers Alley. There's that big parking ramp. That is roughly the location on the parking ramp side where it was. After they decided that they needed to move on because the building was getting too old, in 1911 they built a temple on Park Street. That was more modern. That was really very modern. It had Grecian columns. It was just a very big structure. That is between Walnut and Dutton. Now, both of those properties are no longer there. The congregation started to, we had some very prominent rabbis, and of course, rabbis come and go, you know, like anything else. After this last rabbi left at that period, the congregation fell into a slump. They couldn't really find any rabbi to come. Congregation kept getting smaller. That's when they decided that they couldn't afford to have the Park Street Synagogue any longer. At that point, it was about 1945. It was sold to the Congregation of Moses, which is a conservative congregation. Okay, at that point, we went into People's Church for a while. There were a number of years when we had People's Church. We had services at Kalamazoo College.
People's Church was downtown at that point, wasn't it?
Downtown at that point, yeah. It was in their old building, which is also a very beautiful building. I've seen pictures of it. Eventually, the congregation, this was in the early 1960s, the congregation tried to get back together again. We had some people in the congregation who really wanted to see something happen. So they found a building on Portage Road that was owned by Upjohn. And they rented that for a number of years. And they went in and they refurbished it. And at that point, they had, again, a full-time rabbi. And I think that lasted about 3 years.
The thought was at that point that with the money they had from selling the building, if they had a full-time rabbi, that they would bring enough new people in to be able to afford to put up a new building. And that didn't happen.
Eventually, we went back to People's Church. But People's Church at this time were at 10th Street. We were there for 19 years at that point. 19 years. A long time.
Yeah.
Then something rather miraculous happened. We found out that we were the recipients of a bequest. A bequest, which just absolutely changed everything for us. And that's how we were able to accumulate funds to buy our current building, which is on Grand Prairie.
How important is it from a stability standpoint that you do have a place that you're not sharing with another faith group, and which you've now been calling home for over 20 years? Does that bring stability to a faith-based organization or any other organization for that matter?
I think it makes a big difference. I think people like to have a place to call home, our own building. In fact, the building we're in now was previously a Baptist church whose membership dwindled and they could no longer support that. So we were able to purchase the building from them. The other part of that, I think, is the religious leader. And for many years, we would have student rabbis come from the Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati. And that was helpful. But again, you know, they're young and energetic and have a lot of ideas, but usually they only stayed for a year or two. So it was hard, really, for people to, I think, completely invest in everything going on. I mean, we've all had for a long time a very good religious school, and that helps bring young people in. But yeah, having a building where people know everything is going to be, and we don't have to, you know, fold up at the end of Friday evening service and put everything back into the closet and not be there for another week. You know, certainly, to me, it makes a big difference. I suspect there, you know, if you talk to others in our congregation, it makes a big difference too.
We need to talk about the closet.
Okay.
When we were at People's Church was always absolutely wonderful to us. They just welcomed us. They were just the most perfect people. They had a closet, a separate little closet behind their main sanctuary, which they allowed us to use. So we had people, Helen and Bud Persky, wonderful members of our congregation, longstanding members of Kalamazoo and our temple. They had a beautiful ark, portable ark built. So whenever we would have services, we would pull the ark out of the closet, carry it up the steps to put it on the platform at the People's Church. And then at the end of the services, we would have to take it back down and wheel it around and put it back in the closet. So we were a closet synagogue, really.
The cart with the books on it would be stored there.
Yes.
I can't think of what else, but
yeah, everything. Yeah. And then they also gave us a bigger office that we would share. I think we shared it with the custodian of the People's Church. But we had a corner, so there we had all our religious school stuff. We were really a portable congregation. My take on the difference between being in someone else's home and being in your own home. Thanks to David Lowe, the benefactor of our congregation, because of his bequest, which was huge for us, it was huge. It gave us a chance to have our own home. So instead of being a portable congregation where you were pulling your stuff out of the closet and putting it back, you could put something on the wall. It feels like home. It's very, very important. Now, but continuing to say that, the congregation is again in talking about the future. So the question is, how do you sustain, because we were hoping that the congregation would grow significantly when we had a full-time rabbi. Congregation has grown, but not significantly.
And you've just added a full-time rabbi in the last 2 years,
yes,
correct?
Yes, he joined in 2014. So now the question is, how do we sustain not only the building, but a full-time rabbi? So all of these things are now going on, trying to understand how can we sustain all of this and continue to have all the things that make us feel warm and good about our congregation. We have a very warm congregation, I think it's a very friendly one. It's small. We have, I think, roughly 95 families now. We would love to be over 100. We would be more economically viable if we were just a little bit larger.
Ray Ziering and Jacob Weintraub, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Temple B'nai Israel in Kalamazoo is celebrating its 150th anniversary this year. You can find links with more information about events planned for June 10th through 12th at our website, wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.